welcome to Myth Matters, storytelling and conversation about mythology and why myth matters to your life today. I'm your host and personal mythologist, Dr. Catherine Svala. Wherever you may be in this wide, beautiful, crazy world of ours, you are part of this story circle. Don't worry about a thing. Every little thing's gonna be all right. And I'm gonna stop there because I don't want to leave you with a terrible earworm. But I couldn't resist starting this episode with a little bit of Bob Marley and the Wailers. Reggae always makes me happy, for one thing. And if you're familiar with that song, you know that it's called Three Little Birds. There are three little birds pitched by his doorstep, singing sweet songs of melodies pure and true, saying, "This is my message to you who don't worry about a thing." Now, in the last couple of episodes, we have been looking at the prominent role that animals play in our mythologies. The stories that we tell about the other-than-human world reveal our ideas about our own nature and our complicated relationship to our bodies and instincts and our mortality. These stories contain valuable information about the other-than-human world, and also about how our ancestors learned to live from the others and define what is human. In short, it is the world itself that is the basis for our ideas and theories and feelings and arts, practical and poetic. Now, in today's world, we are so enmeshed in centuries and centuries and centuries of human elaboration, that is, human culture, that the natural world, the source of all of this, is relatively distant. And I think that's one of the reasons that being in nature brings us a particular peace of mind. It's not artificial. And in these times, to be with what is natural is refreshing. I started with Marley's song because I want to talk about birds. Birds are everywhere. And no matter where you live, you can spend time with birds and with bird song. I think bird song is a particular form of magic. Magic for the heart and the soul. In his marvelous book, Becoming Animal, An Earthly Cosmology, David Abrams writes about the fact that birds are always with us through their song. And he notes the nearly universal tendency of birds to sing at dawn and at dusk. And he combines this behavior with the spinning of the world and the fact that at every second, some part of the world, some part of this beautiful planet is moving into dawn or into dusk. I have to share this passage with you. I think it's so beautiful. He writes, "Such is the strange world we inhabit, an immense sphere around whose surface two long lines of birdsong are steadily sweeping, always opposite one another, two breaking waves of vocal exuberance rolling ceaselessly around the planet." Ceaselessly around the planet. The earth is continuously bathed in birdsong. And I've been thinking about this because I moved to Fort Collins a few months ago, and I'm currently enjoying my first springtime here. And the walk that I take almost every day goes past some thickets of bushes and banks of trees that have been so full of blackbirds, red-winged blackbirds. And I don't know if you're familiar with their call, but I find it so extraordinarily cheerful and uplifting. And the song of the blackbirds is my starting point for this episode. Now, I went to a story source book that I have, and it's a reference organized around different indices, ways that storytellers categorize stories by motif and by subject. And it's a good resource to find stories, but also being kind of a story geek, I just find it interesting. It's in and of itself. Anyway, I went to the subject index to look for stories about birds, and I discovered that there were literally 9 pages of stories about birds. So let me give you a little context for this. First of all, the index includes a very wide range of topics. For example, watching, cooking, the sun, water, pitchforks, humility, flower, corpse. You get the picture. Lots and lots and lots of subjects. And many animals, of course. Now, what surprised me is that none of these topics and none of the other animals come close to having the same the volume of stories that have been inspired by birds. Dog, for example, has about 1.5 pages. Ditto for the snake. Cats, bears, wolves, spiders, turtles, those all had 1 page of story references. And I was very surprised to find that the deer, which has been incredibly important to the human species and to human culture, only had about 1/2 page. Now, I'm not just talking about bird generally, I'm talking about types of birds as well. 9 pages that encompassed stories about a wide range of birds, from blackbirds and canaries, crows and ravens, ducks and geese, herons, kites, peacocks, owls, pigeons, eagles, robins, sapsuckers, swans, sparrows. Birds have a particular place in the human imagination. And one of the through lines, one of the important, maybe the most important part of our relationship with birds is through their song. The conversation between birds and between a bird and a human listener. Now, the story that I want to tell you today is one of Hans Christian Andersen's lesser-known fairy tales called The Nightingale. Maria Tatar, who is the director of folklore at Harvard University, put this story on a list of fairy tales that she thinks deserve a wider recognition, and I agree. So I want to share that with you today, and it's going to be take a little bit different form because Hans Christian Andersen's stories are what we call literary fairy tales, which means that we know the author, Hans Christian Andersen, and also that they originated as text. They aren't text records of an oral tradition. The thing is, Andersen intended for his stories to be read out loud. So I'm going to do that following Tatar's translation of the story in her most excellent annotated collection, of Hans Christian Andersen Tales. I invite you to relax and listen to the story. Note the moment or the detail that catches your attention. This opening into the meaning of the story could be particularly useful for you right now. The Nightingale by Hans Christian Andersen. In China, as you may know, the emperor's Chinese and everyone else there is Chinese. This story took place many years ago, but that's exactly why you should listen to it before it's forgotten. The emperor's palace was the most magnificent in the world. It was made entirely of fine porcelain, so costly and delicate that you had to be careful when you touched it. In the garden, you could find the most wonderful flowers. Everything was arranged quite artfully, and the garden stretched so far back that even the gardener could not say where it ended. If you kept on walking, you reached the loveliest forest of tall trees and deep lakes. In the branches of those trees lived a nightingale, whose song was so enchanting that even a poor fisherman, who had many chores before him, would pause when taking his nets in at night to listen. "My God, that's really beautiful," he would say. But then he would return to his chores and forget all about the bird song. The next evening, when the fisherman was back at work, the bird would start singing again, and he would say the same thing. "My God, that's really beautiful." Travelers came from all over the world to visit the emperor's city and admire his palace and gardens. If they happened to hear the nightingales singing, they would all agree, "That's just the best of all." When the travelers returned home, they would describe what they had seen, and learned men wrote many books about the city, the palace, and the garden. They never forgot the nightingale. In fact, they praised the bird above all other things. Now, these books traveled around the world, and some of them found their way back to the emperor of China. And one day, he was sitting on his golden throne, reading one book after the other, nodding his head in delight over the splendid descriptions of his city and palace and garden. And he came across the words, "The nightingale is the best of all." "Well, what on earth?" the emperor exclaimed. "A nightingale? I don't know a thing about it. Is it possible that a bird like that exists in my empire, let alone in my garden? And to think that I had to read about it in a book." The emperor summoned the chamberlain and said, "Apparently, there is a truly extraordinary bird around here called a nightingale. Why hasn't anyone said a word to me about it?" "Well, I have never heard anyone say a word about it," the chamberlain said. "And no one has ever presented the bird at the imperial court." "I want it to appear here tonight to sing for me," the emperor said. "The rest of the world knows more about what's in my kingdom than I do." "I've never heard anyone say a word about it," the chamberlain said again, "but I shall look for it and I will find it." But where could the nightingale be? The chamberlain sped up and down the stairs. He went through the rooms and the corridors. He didn't find the nightingale, and nobody he'd ever met had ever heard of the nightingale. So he went back to the emperor, and he told him that the bird must have been in a fable invented by those who write books. "Your imperial majesty would not believe what people write today. It's all made up and about what can be called black magic." "But the book that I was reading was sent to me by the mighty emperor of Japan," the emperor said, "so It really must be true. I am determined to hear this nightingale. It must be here by this evening. I will grant it my high imperial favor. And if it doesn't show up by then, I'm going to have every member of my court punched in the stomach right after supper. Yes, sir, the chamberlain shouted, and once again he ran all around the palace looking, and this time half of the other members of the court ran around with him because nobody wanted to be punched in the stomach after supper. Everyone was asking about the nightingale that was so famous abroad but completely unknown at home. Eventually, they made their way to the kitchen, and there they found a poor little girl who knew about the nightingale. Of course, I know all about it, she said, and indeed it can really sing. Every evening, they let me take home a few scraps from the table for my poor sick mother, and she lives down by the sea. When I start back, I go through the forest, and I have to stop and rest in the woods, and that is when I hear the nightingale sing. It brings tears to my eyes. Well, little kitchen maid, the chamberlain said, I will arrange a lifetime post for you in the kitchen and give you permission to watch the emperor dine if you can take us to the nightingale. It is supposed to give a command performance at court tonight. And so they all set off for the forest to the place where the nightingale was said to sing. On the way into the forest, a cow began mooing. Ah, said the chamberlain and the members of the court, that must be it. What remarkable power for such a tiny creature. We're sure that we've heard that song before. No, those are cows lowing, the little kitchen girl said. We still have a long ways to go. Then the frogs began croaking in the marshes. How lovely, the chamberlain declared. It sounds just like little church bells. No, those are just frogs, said the little kitchen maid, but I have a feeling we will hear the nightingale soon. And then the nightingale began to sing. There it is, said the little kitchen maid. Just listen, and now you can see it. And she pointed to a little gray bird perched on a branch. Can it be? Exclaimed the chamberlain. That's not at all how I imagined the bird to be. How plain it looks. Little nightingale, the kitchen maid called out in a loud voice, our gracious emperor so wants you to sing for him. With the greatest pleasure, the nightingale replied, and it sang to everyone's delight. It sounds just like crystal bells, the Lord Chamberlain said. And just look at the little bird's throat. You can tell it's singing with all its might. It's astonishing that we have never heard it before. It will be a great success at court. Shall I sing again for the emperor? The nightingale asked, for it believed that the emperor was present. My splendid little nightingale, the Lord Chamberlain said, I have the great honor of inviting you to the court this evening, and there you will enchant his imperial grace with your charming voice. My song sounds best outdoors, the nightingale replied, but it was glad to return with them when it learned of the emperor's wishes. The palace had been cleaned and polished with great care, and in the middle of the great hall in which the emperor was seated, a golden perch had been set up for the nightingale. The entire court assembled. The little kitchen maid was given permission to stand behind the door and listen. People were dressed in their finery, and when the emperor graciously nodded, everyone fixed their eyes on the little gray bird. The nightingale's voice was so lovely that tears began to fill the emperor's eyes and roll down his cheeks. The bird sang even more beautifully, and the music went straight to his heart. The emperor was so delighted that he ordered a golden ribbon be hung around the nightingale's neck. But the nightingale graciously declined it and declared that it had received reward enough. "I have seen tears in the eyes of the emperor," the bird said, "and for me, that is the greatest treasure." And it sang once again with a sweet, sublime voice. The nightingale was supposed to stay at the palace and have its own cage, as well as the freedom to go on outings twice a day and once at nighttime. 12 servants stood in attendance, each one holding tight to a silk ribbon attached to the bird's leg. There was no pleasure at all in outings like that. The whole town was talking about the remarkable bird. If two people happened to meet, the first one just said night, and the other would respond with gale, and then they would both just sigh, with no need for words. What's more, 11 grocers named their children Nightingale, although not a single one of them was able to carry a tune. One day, a big package arrived for the emperor. The word Nightingale had been written on it. "It must be a new book about our famous bird," the emperor said, but it was not a book. Inside the box was a work of art, a mechanical nightingale that was supposed to look just like the real one, except it was covered with diamonds, rubies, and sapphires. When it was wound up, the mechanical bird sang one of the melodies of the real bird, all the while beating time with its gleaming tail of gold and silver. And around its neck hung a little ribbon, and on it were the words, "The Emperor of Japan's nightingale is a paltry thing compared with the one owned by the Emperor of China." "Isn't it lovely?" everyone said. And the person who had delivered the contraption was immediately given the title Supreme Imperial Nightingale Transporter. "Let's have them sing together. What a duet that will be." And so the two birds sang a duet, but it didn't work. It didn't work because the real nightingale had her own style, while the mechanical bird ran on cylinders. "You can't blame it for that," the music master said. "It keeps perfect time, entirely in line with my theories." And so the mechanical bird sang on its own. It pleased them all just as much as the real bird, and on top of that, it was far prettier to look at, for it sparkled just the way that bracelets and brooches do. The mechanical bird sang the same tune 33 times without tiring out. Everyone would have been happy to hear it again, but the emperor thought that the real nightingale should also take a turn. But where had it gone? No one had noticed that it had flown out the window, back to the green forest. "Well, what kind of behavior is that?" the chamberlain exclaimed, and all of the courtiers sneered at the nightingale and declared it to be the most ungrateful creature. "Fortunately, the best bird of all is still with us," they said, and the mechanical bird started singing the same tune now for the 34th time. But no one knew it by heart yet because it was a terribly difficult piece. The imperial music master lavished great praise on the mechanical bird. "Yes," he assured them, "this contraption was far better than any real nightingale, not only because of how it looked on the outside, with its many beautiful diamonds, but also because of its inner qualities. Ladies and gentlemen, and above all, your imperial majesty, you never know what will happen when it comes to a real nightingale. But with a mechanical bird, everything is completely under control. It will sound a certain way, and no other way. You can explain it. You can open it up and take it apart. You can see how the mechanical wheels operate, how they whirl around, and how one interlocks with the other. "My sentiments precisely," they all said. And the music master was given permission to put the bird on display for all to see on the following Sunday. Everyone came to hear the mechanical nightingale. And they did so with so much pleasure. All except that poor fisherman, the one who'd heard the real nightingale sing. He said, "That sounds nice enough, and it's very close to the real thing. Something's missing, but I'm not sure what it is." The real nightingale was banished from the realm, and the mechanical bird took up its place on a silk cushion near the emperor's bed. The music master wrote 25 volumes about the mechanical bird, books so learned and long-winded and full of obscure Chinese words that everyone claimed to have read them and understood them, because otherwise people would have said they were stupid and they might have gotten punched in the stomach. A year went by this way, and the emperor, his court, and all the people in China knew every little twitter of the mechanical bird's song by heart, and that was exactly why they liked it so much more than anything else. But one evening, when the mechanical bird was singing with all its might, and the emperor was lying in bed listening, something inside went boing, and something else burst and went whirr, and gears began spinning wildly, and then the music stopped. The emperor jumped right out of bed and sent for the royal physician. But what could he do? They summoned a watchmaker who deliberated and investigated and then finally patched up the bird after a fashion. The watchmaker warned that the bird had to be kept from overdoing things, for the cogs inside it were badly worn, and if they were replaced, the music would not sound right. That was really dreadful. No one dared to let the bird sing more than once a year, and even that was almost too much. But before long, the music master gave a little speech full of big words and claimed that the bird was just as good as new, and so it was just as good as new. 5 years went by. The entire country was now in deep mourning, for everyone was really fond of their ruler, and the emperor was ill, so ill that he would probably not survive. A new emperor had already been chosen. People were standing outside in the streets, waiting to ask the chamberlain how the emperor was faring. But he just shook his head. The emperor was lying in a huge, magnificent bed, and he looked cold and pale. All of the members of his court were sure that he was already gone, and they were hurrying to get out of the palace to pay homage to the new emperor. Mats had been put down in all of the rooms and passageways to muffle the sound of footsteps, and it was quiet, so quiet in the palace. But the emperor was not yet dead. He lay stiff and pale in his magnificent bed with its long velvet curtains and heavy golden tassels. High above him was an open window, and the moon was shining in through it on the emperor and his mechanical bird. The poor emperor could barely breathe. He felt as if something was sitting on his chest, and when he opened his eyes, he realized that it was death, and he was wearing the emperor's crown on his head and holding the emperor's golden sword in his hand. Eerie-looking faces peered out between the folds of the great velvet curtains. Some looked perfectly dreadful. Others were gentle and sweet. They were the emperor's deeds, good and bad, and they had come back to haunt him now that death was seated on his heart. "Do you remember this?" they whispered one after the other. "Do you remember that?" And they told him so many things that he began to break out into a cold sweat. "I never knew that," the emperor exclaimed. "Music, music! Sound the great drum of China," he cried, "so that I won't have to listen to everything they are saying." But they wouldn't stop, and death nodded at every word that was uttered. "Music, music," the emperor shouted. "My blessed little golden bird, sing for me, sing. I've given you gold and precious jewels. I've even put my golden ribbon around your neck. Sing for me, please sing." But the bird remained silent. No one was there to wind it up, and without help, it couldn't sing. Death kept on looking at the emperor with his great hollow sockets, and everything was quiet, so dreadfully quiet. Suddenly, the loveliest song could be heard from just outside the window. It was the little nightingale, the living one, perched on a branch outdoors. It had learned of the emperor's distress and come from afar to sing and offer comfort. While it was singing, the phantoms all around began to grow more and more pale, and the blood in the emperor's enfeebled body began to flow more and more quickly. Death itself was listening and said, "Keep singing, little nightingale, keep singing." "Yes, I will, if you give me the imperial golden sword, and if you give me the emperor's crown." Death returned each of the treasures in exchange for a song. The nightingale kept on singing. It sang about silent churchyards where white roses grow, where elder trees make the air sweet, where the grass is always green, watered by the tears of those left behind. Death began to long for his own garden and drifted out the window in a cold gray mist. Thank you, you divine little bird," the emperor exclaimed. "Now I recognize you. I banished you once from my realm, and even then you sang until all of those evil faces disappeared from around my bedside. You drove death from my heart. How can I ever repay you?" "You've already given me my reward," the nightingale said. "I brought tears to your eyes when I first sang for you, and I will never forget that about you." The bird continued singing until the emperor fell into a sweet slumber, a gentle and refreshing sleep. The sun was shining through the windows when the emperor awoke, restored and healthy. Not one of his servants had yet returned, for they all believed that he was dead. The nightingale was still there, singing. "You must stay with me forever," the emperor said. "You only have to sing when you wish, and for that mechanical bird, I'll smash it into 1,000 pieces. "Don't do that," the nightingale said. "It has done the very best that it could, and you really should keep it. I can't live inside the palace, but let me come for a visit whenever I wish. In the evening, I'll alight on the branch by your window and bring you pleasure and wisdom with my song. I will sing about those who are happy and those who suffer. I'll sing about the good and evil that remains hidden from you." A little songbird gets around to the poor fishermen, to the rooftops of farmers, to everyone who is far away from you and your court. "I'll come to sing for you, but you must promise me one thing." "Anything," the emperor replied, standing there in the imperial robes that he himself had donned and holding his heavy golden sword against his heart. "Just one thing," the nightingale asked. "You must not let anyone know that you have a little bird that tells you everything, for things will go better that way." And then the nightingale flew away. The servants came in to attend their dead emperor. Yes, there they stood. And the emperor turned to them and said, Good morning. And that's the end. There's a lot to think about in Anderson's little story, and in particular about the tension between human-made culture and art and the natural world that inspires it. I'd like to tell you, first of all, a little bit more about nightingales, and I'm referring here to Maria Tatar. The nightingale, which means singer of the night, is a songbird, reddish and brown plumage, found in Great Britain, Asia, Africa, and on the European continent. It has a very impressive range of whistles and gurgles and trills. And although the nightingale sings both day and night, it's the night song that is considered unusual because there aren't very many birds that sing at night. Most of them stop at dusk. The nightingale has inspired a great many poets and shows up in a number of myths. Most notable in the poetry category is John Keats's Ode to a Nightingale. Keats heard a nightingale singing in a friend's garden a couple of years before he died at the age of 25. And the poem, Ode to Nightingale, is an extended meditation on death and human suffering and beauty and the enduring quality of art and nature. And one of the things that I love about this story is the note that the real bird, that the real bird's song has personality, that the bird improvises and sings from its heart. And that is, in fact, true. There was, and still is in some quarters, the misunderstanding that birdsong is genetically encoded, that birds don't know what they're doing, in other words, that they just sing as they're sort of programmed to do. But that is not true. Every bird learns the language of its species, and it develops its own songs. And birds acquire speech very much like we do, with the same cognitive steps. In her book, The Genius of Birds, Jennifer Ackerman describes this process, which is called vocal learning. And it is fairly rare in the animal world, but it refers to the ability to listen, remember, repeat sounds, to collect acoustic information and use it for your own vocal production. And it turns out that there are remarkable similarities in the song learning process in birds and in the process of humans learning speech. From the process of imitating and practicing right down to the brain structures that are involved and the actions of specific genes. In fact, some songbirds have speech defects, just like some humans do. They stutter. So scientists are learning a lot about the neurological nature of our own learning from birds. Interesting, right? Now, the other thing is that birds are very social, and they are in constant communication with each other. Many of their songs and calls are to share information about food or danger, or they're part of the mating process. And by the way, researchers observe that when females choose the male bird with the best song, that this is an aesthetic choice, and more, he is probably one of the smarter birds, too. Singing also triggers hormones. Again, like us. Birds sing to comfort or warm themselves up and for the sheer pleasure of it. The joy in a bird song is truly a pleasure shared by all who hear it. I imagine that you can easily see the power of the metaphor in the courtiers and the music master who prefer the mechanical bird with its predictability over the improvised and heartfelt song of the real bird. And it makes me wonder about culture and art today. Do we value our response, what we create, so highly that we forget the muse, that we forget the source in the display and expression of our other than human companions and the world itself? Like Anderson, we live in a contradiction. Now, Anderson is elevating and drawing attention to the natural living expression of the bird, and he's doing that by creating something fixed. He's writing a story. And I think the question here is, can we do both? Can we hold both in mind? The value of our making and also our original source. In a podcast earlier this year, I talked about Hillman's terrible love of war and our need to create a culture of peace, a culture that is so satisfying that we aren't willing to destroy it through war of any type. And I think holding this tension is an essential part of this culture of peace. As individuals, maybe this means singing your own song and keeping the mystery in your life alive. We don't want to find ourselves in a world of only mechanical birds, do we? Now, I want to give a big welcome to new email subscribers, Annalie, Helga, Deb, Sam, and Annette. Welcome to Myth Matters. And thank you for subscribing on my email list for announcements about the podcast and my other programs. If you're new to Myth Matters, I invite you to head over to the Mythic Mojo website, where you will find information about the podcast and also about the other work that I do with people to use stories to gain insight into life. A heartfelt shout out to the patrons and supporters of this podcast, whose financial contributions keep it all going. So if you are finding something of value here in Myth Matters and you can afford $5 or $10 a month to sustain the podcast, I hope that you'll join me on Patreon too. There are some special benefits for my patrons, and you'll find those details on Patreon. In closing, a few words from Terry Tempest Williams, excerpted from her book, When Women Were Birds, 54 Variations on Voice. She writes, "Once upon a time, when women were birds, there was this simple understanding that to sing at dawn and to sing at dusk was to heal the world through joy. The birds still remember what we have forgotten, that the world is meant to be celebrated." And that's it for me, Catherine Savela, and Myth Matters. Thank you so much for listening. Take good care of yourself, and until next time, tune in to the sound of the birds and keep the mystery in your life. alive.